When you're shopping for fish nowadays, you not only need to consider how it will taste, but whether it's safe to eat. Concerns about pollutants and overfished species can make you think twice at the fish counter. So what is a fish lover to do? Well, joining me now is Rick Moonen, chef owner of RM Seafood in Las Vegas, and author of the new eco-friendly seafood cookbook called Fish Without a Doubt, The Cook's Essential Companion, which, by the way, is the inaugural selection for Gourmet's new cookbook club. And also here is Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. She joins us once a month to talk about food and related matters on the show. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Hi, Rick.
Hey, good to see you.
Welcome back to both of you. Ruth, can you tell us a little bit about the Gourmet Cookbook Club? You competing with Oprah here?
Well, Oprah doesn't have a cookbook club.
Ah.
And I thought that somebody should have a cookbook club, because what's more fun than talking about cookbooks? But it also came out of the fact that we get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cookbooks every month. And it seemed to me that we were in a better position to judge them. And what we've done is I've said to everybody on my staff, we're going to choose 5 or 6 cookbooks a month, and I want everybody to take them home and cook from them, and we'll pay for the food. So we have 50 people cooking lots of recipes from the book. So we're really giving them a real workout.
I would assume that if you're really sophisticated, you can open up a cookbook and know right away whether it's even going to be interesting. So you're probably discarding 2/3 of the cookbooks right from the start.
We're discarding a lot to begin with. But, you know, it's surprising how many really respected authors print recipes that are incredibly disappointing. And I hate disappointing recipes, because I think they convince people that they can't cook. And what you really want is for people to be excited and encouraged. And a good cookbook makes you so excited about cooking.
Is this your first cookbook, Rick?
Yes, it is, actually. My whole career, people have been asking me about a cookbook, and I never really prioritized it, you know. And
Well, you were kind of busy. You had a whole bunch of restaurants over the years.
Well, I have been busy, but, I mean, it's still, you know, I didn't want to put a cookbook together that was just a compilation of, like, old recipes from restaurants and stuff that I put together. This particular cookbook was more of a challenge for me, because fish books historically did not sell, you know, publishing companies were, because middle America was afraid of cooking fish. They didn't, I mean, and not that the coastal cities were any different, but it was just, it wasn't something that was going to nationally sell. It wasn't popular. So I took a different perspective on it and tried to do a cookbook that was for home cooks, take them to a level they'd never been at before.
Part of the problem with cooking fish is you can, if you cook meat and you leave it in the pan or the oven or whatever for a few minutes more, it doesn't really ruin things, but fish has to be cooked to the exact right moment, and that intimidates a lot of people.
Yeah, knowing when is the fish cooked is probably the number one concern when people, because you're spending a lot of money on a piece of fish.
Nowadays, you know, even more than in the past. It used to be an inexpensive thing to cook, but now, and we'll get into why that is, now you can spend $27 a pound for wild salmon.
Right, and that's why, I mean, 50 pages of Fish Without a Doubt are dedicated to putting you at ease, talking about individual species. Because there's a lot of concern also about sustainability. When you put the two together, oh my God, it's too complicated. It's not that complicated. And I try to break it down to simplistic terms and give a lot of different options. Flexibility is important.
You collaborated on the book with Roy Finneman, who's edited people like Martha Stewart and Ina Garten. Was this a matter of you supplying the recipes and Roy editing?
Not so much. Roy and I did this as a collaborative. I went into a small New York City apartment, tiny stove, regular pots and pans, no excessive BTUs pouring out of the commercial kitchen. I figured that if I could do these recipes by purchasing the fish that morning, which Roy and I would do, going into this kitchen and putting together recipes specifically for this book, that we would accomplish what we wanted. But what Roy really did for me was he kept me from being chefy. I don't have teaspoons in my fingers normally. I don't like this. I want to put another splash in because I tasted it and it needs more acidity. Well, I added a little more vinegar, and he's like, retest. Mm-hmm. He went right across it. He stopped me from being chefy. He was beautiful.
He stopped you and said, let's put that into a measuring cup or a measuring spoon. And, oh, it's 1.5 tablespoons.
Exactly.
Instead of a plop, plop.
There you go. And then if it's something that could be flexible because the ripeness of a tomato and the flavor of a tomato is going to change over the course of the year, then that's in there as well.
Now, how do you wind up becoming an expert in fish? Because there are some cultures where that's the case. In fact, I remember reading once that people who came from certain parts of China, was it Fujian, would come here to work in a Chinese restaurant, and within a week they'd be snapped up by some uptown restaurant because they knew how to handle fish, and a lot of people don't. How do you come to specialize in it?
Well, it was a matter of timing and my career, to be honest with you. I mean, when I was a kid, my dad would take me out to Long Island. We'd go fishing a lot, and it was a very fond memory of mine, the ocean, my dad, you know, and what I experienced. But it wasn't until years later in my career when I started at a restaurant and became partners at Oceana in New York City, where my career took a focus on seafood.
So you'd already worked at Le Cote Basque and Le Cirque at that time, just like everybody else, trying to work your way up.
Correct. I mean, when I graduated from culinary school in 1978, to work in a fine dining restaurant meant French. That was it. No other choice. You know, so I went through the French regime, and then I found myself in Key West, Florida at one point, just to see something out of New York City, because this is where I grew up. And so I did a lot of exposure to the ocean out down there as well, come back to New York. And then I was at the Water Club 6 years, predominantly seafood. And then when I was at Oceana, that was it. And dealing with wild products intrigued me, you know, and I really, truly learned to respect and appreciate what came from the ocean.
You had RM Seafood in 2002, and then you closed that, and now your restaurant is RM Seafood in Las Vegas.
That's right, exactly.
Why did you close RM Seafood in New York? You wanted to move to Las Vegas?
Gambling
man?
I'm of the belief that a restaurant is truly driven by a personality. And I was being offered an 18,000 square foot restaurant in a casino, Mandalay Bay, Las Vegas. I'm like, holy smokes. I didn't originally plan on moving out there, but when I saw the scope of the project, I realized it was important that I was a part of it.
I thought you were going to say holy mackerel.
Oh.
Roy, Rick Moonen and Roy Finnemore have written Fish Without a Doubt, the Cook's Essential Companion, published by Houghton Mifflin. Rick is here, along with Ruth Reichel, who visits us regularly on this show to talk about various aspects of food and cuisine. She is the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, former restaurant critic. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So have you been to Rick's place in Las Vegas yet?
I rarely go to Las Vegas.
But it's become a food center. It used to be you'd go to Las Vegas. I say this from having read about it because I'm not a Las Vegas type. But people would go to Las Vegas and they would be given lots of food for very little money to keep them at the gambling tables. Now suddenly it's a place where you have Rick Moonen, you have Wolfgang Puck, Daniel Ballou, Alain Ducasse, Joel Robuchon. These are some of the most famous chefs.
Yeah. It's an amazing, amazing food city. And it's sort of one of those things is the longer you don't go, the scarier it is to go because suddenly you don't have 10 restaurants you haven't been to. You have 100 restaurants you haven't been to, all of them exciting and wonderful. So I have had one meal at Rick's restaurant, but it was a couple of years ago. It was great.
What is it very different having a restaurant in Las Vegas than in New York or Los Angeles or some of the other big restaurant cities?
It's much more difficult, much more challenging to establish a regular local, clientele.
Yeah, because you're dealing with tourists most of the time.
They perceive the strip restaurants as a pain in the neck. You know, they don't want to go to it. They live off the strip. You know, they want to go to local restaurants. So it takes a little bit longer to massage them into that because there are lean months. I mean, when it's 120 degrees outside, not too many conventions are flying and doing big gatherings because it's unbearable for most. Actually, I don't mind the heat because I've been in kitchens my whole life and there's no humidity. It's kind of cool. I'm used to New York. But, you know, that's really your biggest change. I mean, the rest of it is very transient.
Now, Ruth, what led you to choose this cookbook? I'm sure there were any number of other worthy cookbooks that came in around the same time.
There were a lot of really good books. And I have to say this didn't start out. I mean, I was sort of at the bottom of the pile, and then we started cooking from it. And because I thought fish, it's not everybody's favorite thing. We started cooking from it, and every single recipe we loved. I mean, I kept saying, go cook some more, go cook some more. And then I really started reading it, and I think that everybody should have this book. I really do. I mean, it tells you how to buy fish. It talks about sustainability. It gives you really great tips. It makes it very unfrightening. And Rick has done a couple of videos for us at gourmet.com as part of the cookbook club. We have a conversation going on with both the authors and the readers. And if you go and look at his tips for cooking fish, in 3 minutes, you learn more about fish than most people learn in their whole lifetimes. And it's completely easy, and it really works.
And it also deals with something, as you hinted at there, that has been a concern for you for a long time. We've talked about it on this show, and that is environmental and health issues that are connected with fish and other foods. You have been promoting local food for quite a while now, and also food that doesn't destroy the environment.
Well, and fish is the biggest concern. I mean, if we are not careful, there will be no wild fish left.
In our lifetimes.
In our lifetimes,
aren't
yes.
a lot of the chefs really involved? David Boulay was here recently, and as he was leaving, he said, you know, I'm leading a boycott of, and he listed 3 or 4 different species of fish because he says, you know, we're not going to have them down the line. It seems to be chefs more than any other group are really aware of it. Do you get together and talk about these things?
We do, and there aren't enough chefs, unfortunately, to be honest with you. But at this time, it's becoming a much more hot topic. People are starting to discuss it and are finally doing something about it. I mean, even look at television commercials. You see that more green, more... I want people to think more blue at the same time because everyone's important. Every one of the listeners, everyone that spends money is sending a message of supply and demand.
So when I go out to buy some fish, mm-hmm. Should I go to my local supermarket or do I have to go to some special place?
If you have a special place, then I highly recommend it. Try to create a relationship. Ask lots of questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions because that's what moves things. I mean, the curiosity of the dollar, you know, the person that's coming into your store is really what makes things happen.
But when I go to the supermarket, all I get is this wrapped fish, and I have no idea whether it's any good or not. I have been hearing that the healthiest fish right now are the ones that are bottom feeders. We should avoid the big predator fish altogether, mm-hmm. sharks, swordfish, Chilean sea bass, tuna. You agree with that?
That's true. Although, as far as a health issue, there's so many different... If you're concerned about methylmercury, PCBs, dioxins, they're gonna be concentrated in the larger species. Eat smaller fish.
I don't see fresh sardines in my supermarket or in. Do you see sardines at your local fish store?
I do see sardines. I mean, sardines. You're suddenly starting to see it's newish, but I have been seeing them.
Europeans
at
have been
fish
eating
markets.
Them forever,
yeah.
And they grill them and they taste fabulous.
Well,
but sardines in my supermarket are in a can, and I got to use that little key and roll it up.
Well, as I explain in Fish Without a Doubt, it's don't be so afraid. You know how to pick out a good piece of meat. You're comfortable with that. Why? Because you know what you're looking for. Same thing with a fish. If it's starting to discolor, it doesn't look even, something looks funny, you're probably right to stay away from it. So, I mean, but the only thing you need to steer or be aware of is when it's a piece of tuna in plastic wrap and it's bright, bright red, chances are it's been treated with carbon monoxide to hold that color. You decide whether or not that's okay for you.
When you go to a store that has fish on ice, some people have said you should look at the eyes.
Absolutely. If the eyes are looking right back at you, you can be pretty well assured that it's fresh. I mean, I've been fishing my whole life. I know what I'm looking for.
But there are some fish where the eyes go bad almost immediately, and it doesn't mean anything. So it's not a...
They must be related to me. My eyes went bad when I was a little kid.
No, but I mean, and there are. That's exactly right. And that's why...
So you can't just... there are no rules of thumb.
Well, I would say that for whole fish, what you want is sliminess. Mm-hmm. You want shine on a whole fish. If it's dry, that's not a good thing. Another thing to remember is ice doesn't cool upward. I mean, if you've got whole fish, you want to see ice on top of the fish, mm-hmm. not just it's right. sitting
but, and
on
And if
it.
The fish is cut, though, if it's a fillet, you don't want ice on it, see, because a fish is waterproof, duh, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about it, yeah, of course. So you could submerge the whole fish in ice, and that's where it belongs. Not water, ice. And then as the ice melts, it drains away. I explain how to buy fish, how to store it at home. If you're in a supermarket and you purchase fish, ask them to hold on to it till you're done. Pick it up at the last minute. Keep it cold. You know? And if you adhere to that, then you don't have to worry about when you get home. Is it going to smell fishy? You know, is my kitchen going to be fishy? I used to have a paper route, you know, when I was 12 years old. And it was an apartment building. And as I go through the apartment building, I smelled all the different things that people were cooking. You know, if somebody was cooking fish, it wasn't fishy. If I walked by someone who was cooking a steak, I didn't say, ooh, that's beefy.
Yeah, but if you go into a fish store and there's this certain smell of fish, you think, I better go to another fish store.
If it smells that, yeah, I would agree with you on that. The fish store that I was going to when I was doing this book, there were several of them. I was at Whole Foods at one point. You know, there was a Piscicane, which is the name of a small little market on the east side of New York City. You know, and after a while, you're going, what's new? What's fresh today? And that's what we would work with. I'd meet Roy out front. We'd go in there, and that's how we determined what we were cooking that day. And that's really why we created this, you know, accept alternatives. If you're going to the store, you're pretty sure you're going to find a chicken or a steak or something to roast or, you know, when it's meat. Seafood, you're not 100% sure because a lot of it's still wild. So that's why the direction in this book hopefully will give you some alternatives.
Actually, it's one of the things I like best about this book is the substitutes, the notion that be prepared to be nimble. And if you can't get one thing, get something else.
And I want to come back to that substitution because it's so important. I buy a piece of fish that looks really great. I come home, I start going through cookbooks, and it isn't in any of the cookbooks. and all I really want is for somebody to say, okay, you can cook this the same in the same recipe that I gave you for halibut or red snapper or whatever. And this book has those substitutions. I want to come back to that in just a moment. My guest is Rick Moonen. He has written with Roy Finnemore, Fish Without a Doubt, the Cook's Essential Companion. It is the first selection of the Gourmet Cookbook Club. And here with us as well is the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, Ruth Reichel. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and with one of the authors of the first selection of the Gourmet Cookbook Club, Fish Without Doubt, the Cook's Essential Companion, written by Rick Moonen, who has been a chef at some of New York's most celebrated seafood restaurants, now in Las Vegas with the Las Vegas version of RM. And this book, written with Roy Finnemore, offers 250 simple, it says here, seafood recipes. Simple because people are intimidated again by cooking fish and shellfish?
Well, there's a variety of recipes in Fish Without a Doubt. Most of them are very simple. You can layer a lot of the recipes and make it fairly complex, too. And the one recipe that I had to include was a crab cake recipe that I'd been doing for many, many years, which takes a little bit more preparation, but is well worth it.
Now, let's talk about the substitutions. Mm-hmm. How do I know? Is it simply a matter of I have this thick white fish and there are other thick white fish and I can just automatically assume that I can cook it the same way as the fish talked about in the cookbook?
A lot of it is texture, fat content, and oil content. You know, well, fat is oil. But, I mean, they're pretty much... I would go in either one or two directions, either a similarity in flavor, you know. So, I mean, if you can't get salmon, you can substitute it with Arctic char. And if you don't have Arctic char, you can substitute it with a trout. These are similar, almost related species. Whereas if, you know, or there could be something that's completely unrelated, but it's got it'll respond or perform similarly. So I give different reasons for doing substitutes.
Isn't Arctic char actually less endangered than most salmon? So maybe we should be substituting salmon once in a while for Arctic char.
You know, that
what do you think?
That would be gorgeous. I think we almost need to. I mean, this year, first time in the history of the wild species of salmon, which are all in our Pacific Ocean, that they shut down a fishery. Off the coast of Oregon and California, the wild salmon fishery has been shut down.
Because it was so depleted?
Of course. And then what does that mean? It means we're 5 years too late, because when the government gets involved, unfortunately for me and what I've seen in my lifetime, it shows that we're really just too late.
Well, and on this coast, we've had a similar thing with shad.
Yeah.
I mean, the shad is pathetic this year.
It was a celebration of spring forever.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are shad festivals up and down the Hudson which have been canceled, and they're now shadless festivals.
Yeah.
When I see Atlantic salmon, you say the only wild salmon is Pacific salmon. When I see Atlantic salmon on a label, does that mean that it's farm-raised?
It certainly does. And that's one thing that I discourage. Until there's a better method of farming Atlantic salmon, I highly recommend that people find an alternative.
I've heard that tilapia is one of the few fish that is farm-raised that is okay.
Well, tilapia and catfish, U.S. farm-raised catfish and tilapia.
So catfish is an acquired taste, don't you think?
I think catfish and even tilapia can be, but they're both vegetarian and they're both very, very sustainable as a result for many different reasons. There's a whole other show on sustainability. I could do that. But me being Rick Moonen, you know, chef snob, you know, I didn't really cook with tilapia or catfish. You wouldn't find it on my menu generally until I had the challenge of doing a cookbook. I had to do hamburgers. I had to do, you know, different things that normally wouldn't appear as well. And I started cooking with tilapia and catfish. And I have to tell you, I was very impressed the way it broiled up real simply with just a compound butter. It came out, and the texture of it and everything, I was like, wow, who'd have thunk it?
So would you imagine doing something in a restaurant now?
I do.
Another fish that turns up a lot in restaurants these days is branzino.
Mm-hmm.
Is that endangered or is that okay?
Well, the it's farmed branzino. I mean, it's Ludamare is its original, prototype. I don't know the best way to put it.
The wolf of the sea.
This is a bass from the Mediterranean that I've had wild. It's unbelievable. You just don't see it anymore. So the farmed version is a good relief upon that, I would say. But unfortunately for me, it's still a carnivorous, farm-raised, open net, which is a red alert when it comes to aquaculture. It's not that big of an aquaculture scenario, so it's having an impact on the environment. But if we all decided we're just going to eat branzino now, it's the new sweetheart, and everybody decides to eat it, it will be a problem.
Now, Ruth, there was a report in your old newspaper, the New York Times, in January, about very elevated levels of mercury in sushi tuna, the most expensive tuna, in some cases, Toro, from the bluefin tuna. Is that continuing to be a problem?
That has been a problem. And I was sort of shocked by that article. It was, didn't we all know that? I mean, it has been an issue for years and years. It will continue to be an issue. We have polluted the waters. And if you have these big fish who have been eating little fish that have been ingesting mercury-laden algae for a long time, and then the mercury-laden fish, it's a problem, and it will continue to be a problem. They're trying to change it. By now, they are farming bluefin tuna.
Well, farming never seems to work with the big fish, do they? Does it? Farming always seems to be a problem. But also farming brings other illnesses to these fish.
It brings other illnesses to the fish. You also have terrible environmental problems with almost every kind of aquaculture. With the shrimp, you have a problem with their, you know, cutting down the mangrove forests. And with carnivorous fish, you have the problem that they actually require more fish than they provide.
The fish-in, fish-out ratio is an imbalance.
So where is government regulation in all of this? If we have elevated levels of mercury to the point where it's dangerous, shouldn't the government be preventing us from buying that stuff? Especially when they charge such high prices for sushi in some of those restaurants?
My feeling is, I mean, I'm all for government regulation, but we know it now. So it is up to us to regulate ourselves for a lot of reasons not to be eating those fish. One of the real problems when you get to seafood, especially wild seafood and things like tuna, is the problem is who's government. I mean, you are talking about something that is an internationally caught product. So we can, you know, the United States government can have the best policy in the world, and you still have these giant fish factory ships sitting just outside the 200-mile limit waiting to, you know, track down every living creature in the ocean until there is no more.
It's really been over the last 50 years where technology has had such a traumatic and impact on the biomass of the ocean of the world.
If we can't eat bluefin, is yellowfin tuna better? Or does it have to be wild yellowfin tuna? Does it have to have the words line caught on it, as I've been seeing more and more in some stores? And I'm not even sure whether I can trust those things.
Well, I mean, I buy ahi tuna from Hawaii, which is line caught. And line caught can mean a lot of things. Long lining, which is a method where miles and miles and miles and thousands of hooks are put out, and they attract a lot of bycatch. You know, untargeted species get killed on these lines. That should be a concern, and that it all depends. But when it's just, if you're just talking about health, mercury, et cetera, it's about the size of the fish, really. I mean, the smaller fish are better for you health-wise, but we're eating not lower on the food chain, we're eating the babies, which isn't so cool either. It's a difficult question to answer.
Well, you see, my imagination, line caught is a guy sitting at a pier and he's catching a big yellowfin tuna. That's not
that's just a line.
That's just a false line to follow. You are a strong supporter of responsibly harvested seafood. When did that happen? When you realized that you were in this business for the long run?
Long before it became fashionable. I was actually kind of ridiculed for it in the beginning, about 12, 13 years ago, when Give Swordfish a Break campaign came to my attention. And that was asked of me by Nora Poulion, who's a chef in Washington, who has an all-organic restaurant. And the effort to bring an awareness towards the future or demise, possibly, of the North Atlantic swordfish, they started this campaign. And it was very successful in the long run. It actually created international regulatory changes, thank goodness. Now swordfish, the North Atlantic species, is actually on a sustainable path.
Oh, so it's recovered. I can actually eat swordfish again?
You can, if you so desire.
You also are a founding member of the Seafood Choices Alliance.
Right, and that's what it was. Well, Seafood Choices Alliance came after Give Swordfish a Break. It was started by CWEB and the National Resource Defense Council. The two of them got together and started that campaign. And back then, when I was talking against swordfish, about giving swordfish a break, you know, stop eating it for a little while, guys. It's not a boycott. It's just we need to pick other species, all right? Let's lay off for a little bit. We can see, because it'll come back, and they do. That's when I was, like, ridiculed when I go to the Fulton Fish Market.
Now, Ruth, what's happening when you're cooking seafood recipes? Are you limiting yourself to the fish that aren't endangered or don't endanger us?
We are really trying to be as sustainable as possible. Now, one of the issues with sustainability is you do have to ask a lot of questions. So, you know, something on the West Coast may be fine because it's caught in a different way than something you're buying on the East Coast, or if you're shopping at a place where they, you know, deal with day boats that go out. So a lot of this is, and one of the things I love about Fish Without a Doubt is it encourages you to not only educate yourself, but ask a lot of questions when you're shopping, which is the only way you're going to find out.
What about shellfish? In the past, I was afraid to eat mussels because people are getting sick. Are they safe these days? Or clams?
I highly oysters? Encourage that people eat as much as possible the bivalves because they clarify the oceans. And if we can clear up the oceans, then we're going to start more eelgrass. The ecosystems will get healthier, and we'll be back to where we were years ago.
They're truly a win-win situation. You know, clams, oysters, mussels, they taste delicious, and they are actually great for the environment.
Well, New York used to be the greatest place to get oysters in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather when the Dutch came here, there were shells all over. They crunched as they walked on shore. All gone. So they can be endangered as well, can't they?
Well, the, up through aquaculture. I mean, I would like to see the pressure of aquaculture, too. I would, if I saw oyster beds increased dramatically because of the pressure, because of the demand, that'd be awesome.
Now, you can go to Chinatown and some other places and get live shrimp. Are they better?
They sure taste better.
Well, whenever it comes to something like a crustacean, or if you get them as close to being alive as possible, because immediately they start to deteriorate. That's why a lot of times you'll find them frozen. Uh-huh. I don't discourage frozen shrimp if it's from a sustainable source.
Flash frozen. That's what Julia Childs used to push.
Exactly. Flash frozen shrimp are terrific. I mean, you can even have them with the heads are still attached. And there's a lot of fat and meat in there that if it's handled correctly, it's absolutely a treat.
You could also buy scallops live in the late fall, but you don't see that all that often. They do taste better as well, don't they?
Oh, yeah, no question. But, I mean, there's direction in fish without a doubt that'll tell you when you're picking out a scallop. Oftentimes there's a technique where they'll dip it. Mostly it'll be dipped unless you ask otherwise. They put it in a solution to extend its shelf life, which makes them all white and fluffy. If they all look like marshmallows, chances are they've been dipped. And you don't want that because they're a mussel. So once you try to cook them, if you want to caramelize them, which richens the flavor and makes them even more buttery, that mussel is going to contract, the juice is going to come out that they absorbed, and you're going to end up steaming it. So you need to be sort of educated on what you're looking for.
Now, when you say mussel, you mean M-U-S-C-L-E, not M-U-S-S-E.
I didn't know this was going to be a spelling bee. I did not study for this language. Yes, I do mean that.
You said it's a muscle. I thought, wait, a scallop is a muscle?
Well, it's an abductor muscle. I will clarify that. No, but I mean, they're not supposed to all be white. Sometimes they're a little off-white. But if they're sticky and they smell like butter and they're just clean, that's what you want.
Do you think one of the reasons, Ruth, that Americans are intimidated by seafood is because there's so much more to learn?
I don't think that there's so much more to learn. I think if you were just starting in on beef, you would find that there was an awful lot to learn, too. I just think that for most of us, it's less familiar. If you grew up on the ocean, you probably are not intimidated by fish.
We do have some recipes that we've posted on our show page from the cookbook. If you were just going out today because of this time of year, and trying to cook something for tonight's dinner, what do you think that you would look for first?
Well, coming up soon is the virgin herrings, you know, the machos herrings. That's the season that's right around the corner. This is springtime, you know. So
and herrings are also, they're fish that are bottom feeders, so they are healthier to eat than other fish, aren't
correct.
They?
Yeah, that's a lower food chain item selection. But they're pickled, you know, so if for something from the book, it would be shad, right? I mean, but there is no shad to be had. So, I mean, we're stuck with
I'm so sad.
Is it my turn? Oh, I'm glad. No, I guess your best thing is to just go to your fish market. Like, make it a stop. Make it a weekly thing and try to make a variety. Chances, if you keep mixing what you go after, then you're doing your job as far as making things more sustainable. It's when we lopside it that it becomes problematic.
Just one more thing. Grilling fish, we have very little time. But right. Fish, we're afraid that they're going to fall apart when we grill them. How do we prevent that?
Real quickly is just to make sure you have a hot fire. And I recommend just slathering them with a little bit of mayonnaise, flavored mayonnaise if you can, because mayonnaise is predominantly fat. It'll keep it from sticking. You don't have that problem.
And you don't flip it over a lot of times.
You flip it once.
Ruth, anything you want to say in passing?
Yeah, I would like to mention that to encourage people to join the Gourmet Cookbook Club, we're having a sweepstakes. And if you go to gourmet.com, it's a trip to one of my favorite cookbook stores in the world in London.
We have to leave it there. Ruth Reichel, Rick Moonen, thank you so much for being on our show today.
My pleasure.